We're live.
Oh my gosh, Z-Pack, you are never going to believe what we're doing today. Well, actually you would because we put it in the title. We are unveiling how much Neanderthal Tom and Logan actually are. And we are going to talk about the genetic testing results that we got from the sponsor of the show today, 23andMe, who did our genetic testing for us, and also offer you guys a half-off Health and Ancestry coupon for healthcare professionals. We did it for everybody at first, and now we're contracting to healthcare professionals. Why? Because with our guest today, we are going to talk about how us frontline healthcare people can actually get less scared about the inevitable advent of consumer genetic testing. How do we talk to our patients about it? How do we understand some sense of results? What does it even mean? So we're gonna learn a bunch, especially exactly how white Tom Heineber is. And I have to read a quick disclaimer because of laws. The views and opinions expressed during this Facebook Live show are those of the presenters and do not represent the views of 23andMe. Okay? They say that because you know I'm going to go loco because I have a special guest today, Dr. Mylinda Massart, who is a family medicine doc, a PhD in awesomeness. She's going to tell you about that. From UPMC in Pittsburgh, and she happens to be quite knowledgeable. I would say she's the chosen one in bridging the gap between primary care, genetic testing, and the future of everything. Mylinda!
Hey, Z-Pack, how's it going? That was quite an introduction. Well, I'm not really sure how to live up to that.
You already have just by showing up, because the minute I met her, first of all, I gave her the wrong address. So she shows up in the lobby with her family, and they're just looking confused. And I was like, can I help you? Oh,
it's
you.
I thought he was punking us.
Yeah.
And videotaping us from up above while we walked around the halls 15 times.
All of which was, in fact, happening. It was happening. But we decided, we finally got you into the right place, and we were talking, and I realized you are, in fact, the chosen one for primary care to actually help us on the front lines understand why genetic testing. First of all, why is it a thing? What we can do with our patients to better understand what they're going through when they do this testing, why they would even do the testing, and how we can have the conversation that's important. Tell me a little bit about your background. How did you even get into the space of genetics at all? Because most family docs are like, forget that.
Yeah, so actually I did my PhD first before I went to med school.
It's backwards.
It's backwards. I don't recommend it. It's long and expensive because they don't pay for it that way.
Right.
I spent, you know, many, many years in a research lab, and I still have a little bit of PTSD from that. And
what was your model? Was it mice? Was it
yeast.
Drosophila?
It was yeast.
You took it all the way down to yeast?
All the way down to yeast.
That would give me PTSD because I still see fruit flies in my nightmares.
So every time I walk by a bakery and I smell that delicious smell, which other people brings like happy memories,
right.
I start twitching just a little bit, but it's all good.
Well, you know something funny? It's off subject. I used to have to make the medium that the fruit fly lived on, and that involved a lot of yeast.
Yeah.
So the same smell actually gives me that PTSD of stirring a vat of fruit fly medium.
And only do we call fruit flies Drosophila when they, like, you know, invade the house and attack.
Exactly. I had some the other day, and I was like,
and we start looking at their eye colors.
Yeah, I was looking at their eye colors.
Showing their children.
Well, they have a variegated red-white eye polymorphism.
Exactly.
So I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, it's okay. So I did my PhD first, and I was at the University of Utah, which a lot of amazing things were happening in Salt Lake City at that time, including a local company that I won't name that was developing and starting a business based on the finding of the BRCA mutations.
Oh.
And it turned out that they did a lot of their preliminary research on the Ashkenazi Jewish community in Salt Lake City, of which I was a member.
Ah.
I know most people think Salt Lake City
Happy
and
Hanukkah.
Think Ashkenazi Jews, but it's true. Thank you for the Hanukkah greetings. Mm-hmm. And
so you're the one non-Mormon in Salt Lake City?
No, actually. I was one of many, many thousand.
Oh.
So, because, you know, as soon as the Mormons said, this is the place,
yeah.
The Jews said, they need commerce. So if you walk around downtown Salt Lake City, it's like all these buildings with Jewish names. So Jewish families have been there for a long time.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the research was done there, and I got to meet many great geneticists through that experience, and I ended up spending a lot of time when I wanted to run away from the lab, and I would go to the clinical genetics side of the world and hang out with them and learned a lot. And I decided to go on to med school. I wasn't married yet. I didn't have kids, and I knew I was only going to be 4 years older in 4 years, so why not go to med school? And
just kind of a side thought. You know what? That's cool.
I'm just trying to inspire everybody who has a dream. Like, you're only going to be 4 years older in 4 years, so just
you
do
know,
it.
It's like you could have gotten a mochaccino, or
I could have.
I could get a 4-year degree and then do another bunch of years of residency.
Yeah. Right. So I went off and did med school, and I was going to become a clinical geneticist. Mm. And then I got to my 3rd-year clerkship for family medicine. And this crazy thing happened. I loved it. And whoa. I was on week 3, and the attendings came over and sat me down, and they're like, Mylinda, this is an intervention. You are not a specialist. You need to face that. You're a primary care doctor, and you just have to come to terms with that. So that sort of rocked my world, and I left that day kind of dazed and confused and not sure what to do. And then my phone rang, and I will admit this was like my first generation flip cell phone. And sure enough, the call was actually coming from an ER doctor in Italy who was taking care of a patient that I had done research on during a postdoc I did during the beginning of med school. And I got to travel all around the world and characterize this rare genetic disorder and visit the families and the children. And they called me up and they said, you know, this child from your research group is in my ER with the flu, and I really don't know how to take care of him with this disorder that he has. And so we ended up talking and we worked through things, and I hung up the phone and I realized that, you know, genetics is not really just a subspecialty. Genetics doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's really about all of our lives. It's about how it affects our family and all of our health. And lo and behold, because, you know, I really loved family medicine, I easily convinced myself that with the onset of all of the completion of the Human Genome Project, that medicine was only going to become more and more molecular in the future, and that really genetics and primary care was a perfect marriage.
Yeah.
And that there's not going to be enough genetic specialists in the world to handle all of the genetics that was eventually going to come out in every area of medicine. And I always challenge everyone, like, name me a subspecialty in medicine where genetics is not going to play a role.
Yep.
And it's going to in every single field. And so flash forward a few decades, and here we are in this era of precision medicine, and people can spit in a tube and get their results back a month later from direct-to-consumer testing. Their doctors can order genetic tests now through the clinics and through the hospitals. And literally we're starting to see the impact of all of the research over the last 20 years start to affect how we make medical decisions.
So that's an amazing story, because you now have the perspective of the researcher and the family physician. So there are plenty of hematologists and specialists that kind of dabble in genetics. But to have the family medicine perspective brings it all together, because you have to talk to patients about this stuff carefully, and now they're empowering themselves with the data. We're moving, as you said, into the realm of precision medicine, so you can actually know much more about a patient and their aptitudes and their sort of risks, right? But, you know, as the FDA sort of says, right, none of this stuff gives you an answer per se. It is, well, it may be a risk. It may be that you have to change what you do in diet and exercise and the medicines you take and how you think about yourself. And it's that kind of stuff that can be transformative from a primary care perspective.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you a question. I love how the garbage guy just shows up, right?
The Z-Pack all got super distracted. They were like, dude, the truck is backing up now. Oh my God, look at it. It's going to back up. They're going to get the
That's
trash.
That's good, because I was rambling, so they didn't miss anything anyway. Like,
is there a genetic locus for that kind of ADHD that has to do with trash?
I think it definitely segregates with being a physician.
That's your squirrel. The reason we were really excited that you could come all the way from Pittsburgh to talk with the Z-Pack is that you have quite a bit of experience, again, kind of motivational interviewing, talking patients through results. And it so happens that we have results for two Neanderthals, Tom and Logan.
Dun, da, da.
And we can pull them up and maybe let's have Tom, why don't you sit where I'm sitting?
Get in there,
let's
Tom.
Do it.
And I'm going to take your phone.
This is a consult. I'm getting a
and
consult.
And then Logan's going to move around.
Well, this is great, because I think this really kind of mimics real life for a lot of primary care doctors right now. And their patients are coming into their offices you know, and you know, everyone knows, right, what the visit says in that little line.
It says chief complaint, balls itch.
Is what, no, it doesn't, because it's whatever the patient felt comfortable telling the stranger on the other, you know, end
of the
phone.
One more thing, doc, right.
Right. So what they're really, the real agenda that they're coming in with isn't always clear. And so a lot of primary care doctors around the country now are in their office and they're completely blindsided because the patient comes in and says, hey, doc, look what I did. Help me figure this out.
Yeah.
And you know, honestly, Z-Pak, this is why when we talk about genetic testing, people freak out in healthcare. Oh my gosh, it's going to panic people. We don't know what to do with the data. It's going to slow down our visits. So this is what we want to talk about, because I actually think the opposite is true. Our patients are empowering themselves with this data. Why would they do that? And what can we get out of it? We ought to be there to help them and be their shepherd. They're going to turn to someone else.
It's actually really exciting because it's a chance to really strengthen your relationship with your patient. And you know, we're in this whole new world now of patient-driven medicine, right?
Yeah.
We are not mom and dad. The patients are really driving the bus. They're looking everything up on Google. They're getting high anxiety coming in and talking to us about it.
Yep.
But you know, we're in this whole world of shared decision making. We are a team. We are partners. But this is real stuff, and it is scary. And a lot of doctors, I gave a talk once last year, and one of the doctors, when I started talking about this, said, well, that's okay. I'm going to forbid my patients from doing this type of testing. And I just laughed.
Right,
and I was like,
happen.
Dude, your patients already have done this kind of testing. They just haven't brought it to you yet. And it's going to happen. It's really going to happen.
Yeah. Did you end that statement with old man and then snap your fingers? Because that's what I do.
I was in front of a couple hundred people, so I had to be like a little more professional. But
do you think that would stop me, Z-Pak?
Hopefully he's not watching right now. But you know, it's really going to happen. And if it hasn't happened to you yet, those of you out in the Z-Pak, it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. Yeah.
So here's what it's like. And so when these dingbats, I have a pirated version of Adobe. Let me get rid of that. Sorry, I mean, everything's on the up and up, guys. So when you're actually signing up and you say, and we're just going to, I'm going to talk about 23andMe, but this could be any genetic testing, okay? The FDA has certain requirements on how to actually educate patients going through the process so that we don't have a situation where they're freaking out, panicking, or misinterpreting this data. And the doctors and nurses and nurse practitioners and PAs and everybody who takes care of patients can help with this. But take a look. Let me brighten this up here if I can. So the first thing is you choose your health report. So you decide, do you want to receive actual health reports or just the ancestry stuff? And you can decide here. And you can even say, ask me again later because I don't know. Then the next sort of page, they have you go through choosing which reports you want to get. And they go through some difficult ones. For example, late onset Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease. So if you don't want to know about some of those risks, now you got to understand one thing, and Mylinda will talk more about this. Even if these results show an increased risk, it's not like the old school Punnett square Mendelian genetics where it means you're 25% or 100% or whatever, that it just is predicting your destiny. It's a risk factor that's associated with the condition, like many other risk factors, like smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, etc., family history. So opting in or opting out allows you control over what information you want to get. And here's even more information about late onset Alzheimer's, for example. So they talk about over the age of 65, consider the following when deciding. There's no cure for Alzheimer's. The report does not cover all variants that may be associated with disease. The risk variant for this condition is common, depending on ethnicity, up to 15 to 40% of people are expected to have one copy. So that you shouldn't panic when you get these results. And the genetic result with the highest risk is associated with up to a 60% chance of developing Alzheimer's by the age of 85. That is not a sentence of developing Alzheimer's, right? But they want you to understand this risk before you make the decision to get the data. Same with Parkinson's. They go through the different risk factors. We won't dwell on that. And that, so that's something that I wanted you guys to know when the FDA sort of said, okay, 23andMe, genetic testing, you can say these particular health traits can be given to patients. You have to educate them. You have to make sure they can opt in. The same with research. If you want your genetic data used for research, you can opt in. You can also opt out, right then or later. So any thoughts on this, Mylinda?
Yeah, actually, I think you brought up two things that are really important to talk about. So one is that we really aren't talking about classical Mendelian genetics. There are some reports that do fall into that category, especially when you're looking at carrier status. But most of these things are really looking at associations. So if you have a single nucleotide variant, right, it's not the same old classic thought or concept of a mutation, right? Mutation meant associated with disease. You have this mutation, you have this disease, or you carry this mutation, your children have X percent of inheriting that disease. But this is really different, right? So if you have these little variants in your DNA, then they may be more associated with certain onset of disease or specific traits or fun little facts like, can you smell asparagus in your pee? But they're not direct.
I can totally smell asparagus. Yeah. In Tom's pee.
I can spell asparagus. A-S-P-A-R-G-U-S. Wait, that wasn't right. I missed the A.
We said smell, not spell.
Oh. Damn it.
Tom has auditory dyslexia.
That's okay.
It's a special allele. Back to you, Mylinda.
And so, so it's really important to be able to explain to patients that these are, you know, associated with a likelihood of developing that or having that. It is not a one-to-one cause. So that's one thing that's really important. I think the second thing that's really important to primary care doctors is this whole concept of motivational interviewing that we learned back in med school and in residency. So if you can understand people's risk for developing certain disease, it's not one-to-one, it's not 100%, but you can still use that to your advantage. So the example I always give generically, this is not related to the reports that we're talking about today, is, you know, when you talk about smoking, right, all of us have gone through this thousands and thousands of times as a provider, and you tell someone that, you know, one out of 100 people who smoke the same as you are going to develop lung cancer, or one out of 50 is going to develop, you know, severe COPD by the time they're 50 and be walking around with an oxygen tank. Our patients play those odds, right? They play those odds. They're like, okay, I'll take that. That's all right. But if you say, no, I can look at your DNA report, and I want to clarify again, this is not coming from the reports that we're discussing today. This is talking about precision medicine in general, that no, you are the one who's going to get cancer if you continue to smoke like this, or you are the one who's, you know, 80 to 90% likely to get end-stage COPD by the time you're 50. That is a really different kind of motivation, right? You're way more likely to listen to that and be willing to make some lifestyle changes.
So that gets me into this question. What is Tom more likely to be? White, whiter, or whitest?
Or clear.
Let's look at his clear report. So, Mylinda, here's Tom's ancestry report.
Okay.
So it looks like he is 83% British and Irish.
I want to hear the accent to prove it.
Can you do it?
No. Sometimes these reports aren't right, because as I said, it's just a likelihood.
It's a likelihood.
Although the ancestry is pretty accurate.
Look at this. 99.9% European. But you're 0.1% Middle Eastern and North Africa.
Your ancestors did not travel.
They did not, no.
Try this for me, Tom. Let's just do a test.
All right. No, 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 no. As a 99.9% white, I can't do that. No, I won't.
There you go. See, that was diagnostic.
Can you say my son's name? Chaim.
Can't do that either. No. Too white. Too white, yo. But if you guys want to know about some good diversified options for your portfolio, come talk to me, okay? Or which yogurts are the best, which flavors of vanilla yogurt are the best. Yeah.
Oftentimes, Tom will say things like, me and Buffy are going to go down by the club and have a quick quick mojito.
Mojito.
Well, my favorite part of this report is kind of interesting because, you know, physicians are constantly analyzing their surroundings, right? And patients often feel like we have to touch them to do our exam. But the truth is, when they walk in the door, we're already examining them from head to toe. And the frontal bossing, like, it was noticeable right when I walked in the door.
Yeah,
And then you look here.
More Neanderthal variants than 52% of customers. You are in the majority for Neanderthal.
What's up? Here's the thing. Neanderthals are misunderstood, you guys, okay? Listen, they were a sweet, gentle, kindly folk, okay? And the chimp, our chimp ancestors just murdered them like a bunch of dicks. So I feel proud to be half Neanderthal.
I can't share the link to the show now. To most of my
Tom is usually good at ruining a show with curse words, but luckily that was not a curse word in most cultures, just in ours. So in the setting of Neanderthalism, which of course explains the cursing, the rest of the stuff, and then there's your actual DNA family. So how many DNA relatives
are
actually?
That's a lot of relatives.
You have a lot of relatives that you have used 23andMe calculating your DNA family breakdown.
Yeah.
I will tell you that mine was over 2,500 today, though.
Wow, so nice.
Apparently, my family did travel a lot.
Yeah.
Mine was one drunk hobo. This is one dude.
Named Roscoe.
Named Roscoe.
Who just roamed the plains.
Roscoe, are you? So
we're kind of laughing and making a joke out of this, but the truth is, there's a lot of useful information. People ask me all the time, you know, ancestry is fun. It's a hobby. There are certain groups who really focus whole websites on developing ancestry and family trees. But the truth is, clinically, it's also really interesting. And actually, ACOG came out with new guidelines last spring that said we should no longer racially profile our patients as they walk in the door. Because the truth is, we're all mutts at this point. We really are. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell what percent of anything anybody is when they walk into my office. And yet, in terms of practicing obstetrics, you need to talk about carrier risk, and there are certain ethnic panels for carrier testing that are available. And so historically, we profiled our patients and we said, maybe we should test for cystic fibrosis, or maybe we should test for you know, some of these other conditions that may run more in your type of ethnicity. Right. But the truth is, really, you can't know anyone's ethnic origins now without doing ancestral testing.
See, so this to me is way more advanced than how we normally practice medicine. Mm. That intuition and looking at somebody, well, they're African American, so we think about blood pressure and we think about this and we think about that.
But they may also be Ashkenazi Jewish, exactly. And you don't know that.
Exactly right. You don't know that. And speaking of not knowing, let's take a look at Logan. So Logan did not know his ancestry until, let's go to the reports ancestry. This is slow. There we go. So you are 28.7% British and Irish.
Woo.
And the rest is where it gets interesting.
So European, 72%.
East Asian and Native American. So that may be the
Hispanic.
The Mexican lineage that you have. Sub-Saharan African.
I'm black, yo.
Finally.
Yeah. I knew it.
I didn't know there were a lot of colonies in sub-Saharan Africa.
Oh, snap. But I was going to say we finally have a little bit of street cred at Z-Dog Industries.
1.4%.
1.4% street cred, Middle Eastern and unassigned, which I'm going to say is alien.
Alien for sure.
Alien DNA, right? You've encountered that in your practice.
Absolutely.
On the daily.
I'm going to say it's pygmy.
We saw an alien dog
2.9% pygmy.
At the airport. My kids didn't believe me.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That, well, you know, so my report, which we won't pull up right now, but it basically said 91% Middle Eastern, which goes with my Zoroastrian Persian lineage, even though my parents were in India. 9% about 9% was South Asian. So at some point in the history, my inbred Zoroastrian relatives outbred with a South Asian local person. And now there's me, who has mostly three arms and other things too. Two small extra pinky toes, which provide extra support in the deserts of the Middle East. It's all for a reason. Did you find anything surprising in your ancestry when you went through?
No, in fact, actually my ancestry came back exactly what I predicted. I knew where the deviation was. So I predicted I would be 75% Ashkenazi and a quarter Scottish.
Yeah.
And that's actually what came back.
That's nice. That's so validating.
So that was very validating.
Yeah.
And
That's quite good. Now, that was ancestry. Now, if we look at genetic health risk, which we talked about in the FDA sort of education modules and the disclaimer we talked about, let's take a look at Logan. So what does this mean? Celiac disease, slightly increased risk. Logan, are you going to have a case of the glutens?
Oh, no.
What does this mean?
So this is where now all the ZPAC docs and all the other docs out there in the world are like, oh, no.
Right.
And like the heart just like drops into the stomach and the anxiety and the sweaty palms and everything comes up.
I have that on the regular just like for going. Being alive, yeah.
So here, this gets back again to what I was talking about before. This is not classical Mendelian genetics, right? This is not that you have this mutation and that you have celiac disease. This is that you have one little variant or possibly a few variants that were looked at that travel more frequently with people who have celiac disease than with people who don't have celiac disease. So this does not actually mean that you will ever develop celiac disease. And it's not conclusive. It's not a clinical diagnosis or a clinical diagnostic test. It's interesting, and it may be interesting if you have been suspicious for a while that you're having symptoms of celiac or that or gluten insensitivity.
Yeah,
all that bloating and groaning and that you guys hear over there.
He bloats and groans all the time
after all the bread. So, yeah. But again, it doesn't replace your clinical intuition and your clinical decision making and the process that you would go through with the patient, mm-hmm. you would still want to know, well, what are the symptoms you experience? Maybe you experience no symptoms and mm-hmm. can eat all the bread in the world. And maybe you do have some symptoms. So let's go back to what I learned in med school and residency in terms of diagnostic testing for yeah. celiac disease.
Yeah.
And let's do some of those and investigate.
And that's spot on. And if you even read what they say here, this test does not diagnose celiac disease or any other health conditions. Talk to a healthcare professional if this condition runs in your family. If you think you might have it, or if you have any concerns about your results. Now here's, and I wasn't going to talk about this, but I think it's worth bearing out. When you do 23andMe, they have a bunch of raw data too. Now the FDA said these are the things that are approved to talk about using the right education, because you want to set the expectations of what this is useful for.
The things that are in the reports.
Things that are in the reports. Now you can send your data out to outside companies that aren't the primary genetic testing company, and they can run all kinds of reports with the kind of associations that you mentioned. Well, this haplotype is associated with this and this and this and this. But what does that mean? People get those confused. They go, those are 23andMe reports. They're not. They're actually outside analysis. And that's where it gets, where you go down a rabbit hole where people don't really know what it means.
Right. And if you're a provider yeah. and your patient starts bringing you not just this type of report that we're reviewing today, but other third-party interpretation reports that they took the raw data. And just so you know, as far as I know, every company out there doing direct-to-consumer testing also releases the raw data.
Mm-hmm.
That's considered owned by the participant.
Mm-hmm.
And so people can take that raw data from any of those places and run it through those third-party interpretation sites. Mm-hmm. None of those are directly related or approved or right. authorized by any of the companies where the original data came from. They're also, that raw data is not clinically validated. It right. has not gone through the rigorous testing that all of the things that are in formal reports has mm-hmm. gone through. And it does have potential danger and pitfalls. So as providers, I think it's really important that we understand the difference between raw data and reports
mm-hmm.
and that we can advise patients on the challenges of raw data. And again, I always say just go back to what you know. You are a really great provider. You look at that patient who's your patient and you say, what's going on? What's driving all of this? Are you just bored and you're like interested in yourself and you want to have all this understanding? Mm-hmm. Or is there something going on that we haven't talked about in your health that's upsetting you and keeping you up at night and you're out there searching, right? People who are searching on Google and finding all this information and bringing it to us, I don't think it's because they're bored. I think they're really trying to understand themselves and find answers.
You nailed it. So my college buddy, and I've talked about this before, he had this sneaking suspicion that his dad, who had passed away of pancreatic cancer, wasn't his dad, wasn't his biologic dad. He saw him as his father and still does. But so he went out and did 23andMe testing to find out, well, maybe I'll learn something. And he found out, lo and behold, he was half Puerto Rican and a large proportion African native and such and such and so on. So his dad, who was white, British, it was statistically very unlikely. Then he talked to his mom, and his mom admitted, no, it was this and that, and this is what happened.
But really, what was his fear? That he was going to get pancreatic cancer.
I think that was a good piece of it.
Right.
I think the other fear is that he never felt like he fit into his family.
Mm-hmm.
His two brothers were biologically the dads, and he was trying to find a sense of identity in who he was.
So there's a lot of reasons that drive people to do this. And I think as providers, that's really our job. Not necessarily to reinterpret this data. That's mm-hmm. not our job. These are not clinical tests. If there is something interesting or useful or provides a clinical hint, it's our job to take that, explain it to the patient, and go do the clinical test that's appropriate. However, really, it's about understanding the motivation. What's driving the patient to seek this information? What are their real concerns and mm-hmm. their real fears? And then getting to that.
Yeah. Well, looking at real concerns and real fears, are we worried that Tom is going to get age-related macular degeneration? Variant detected, not likely at increased risk. So what does that mean, my Linda? How would you interpret that for Tom?
So
Let me give you real quick. Let me give you my family history. My father has AMD, and so does my father's mother.
So you have a family history of age-related macular degeneration, the number one cause of blindness in the developed world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. And again, this suggests that that you do have a variant. But they're saying in their report that the variant detected does not place you at higher risk. So my simplified way of interpreting this is that, again, we're not talking about simple Mendelian genetics anymore, where there's one mutation, one disorder. We know that there's the combined addition of many different variants throughout our genome, plus our lifestyle and our environment and our exposures, all the omes that we talk about in precision medicine. And all these things combine and then lead up to disease, right?
Right.
Now, you have a strong family history.
Yeah.
As a provider, that would make a red flag for me, right, in your electronic health record. I would already be concerned and be talking to you about what are the things you could do in your lifetime to reduce your risk of developing age-related macular degeneration. Then I would tell you this one report is talking about one variant that, again, looks again at the risk of developing this particular disorder. Your variant is not traveling with the high-risk group. And that's the limit of our understanding right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
But through tons of additional research that this company is doing, through all of the genomes they've collected, through the large precision medicine initiative, there is going to be tons and tons of research that's going to allow us to understand all of these variants in greater context, what they mean in combination with our lifestyle and our exposures, and give us a better predictive model. But we're not there yet. So if I was your family medicine provider, I would say that's really interesting. Does it make me feel any safer? Probably not. I really think we still need to work on all the lifestyle things you can do and the proper screening that we can do because of your family history.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And again, to remind you guys, 23andMe is offering a 50% off Health and Ancestry so you can try it for frontline healthcare providers. Because then if you go through it yourself, like I did, like Logan did, like Tom did, you learn a lot about the process so that you can talk to your patients better about it. And I got to say, genes aren't your destiny, okay? Okay, here's my hive. Now watch this. Look at Tall. Look at Tall Tom. Now watch this.
A great equalizing
Okay, who's parents. Equal now? Who's equal now? Okay? Suck it, genes.
That's right. So it's just one more piece of data, right? Yeah. We do all sorts of lab work. We collect all sorts of vital signs. All of these bits are one more piece of data that we then put together and still use our brains because it's not all gone to computers yet. To put that together, our knowledge of the patient, our knowledge of their life and their exposures, and then give them the best advice we can.
Tom, late onset Alzheimer's disease, good example of that. You have one copy of APOE4.
Right.
So you're heterozygous APOE4. What does that mean? It doesn't mean you're going to get Alzheimer's disease. It means that you're at a slightly higher risk statistically because this gene tends to travel with people who get that. And so what does that mean? It means you probably shouldn't smoke. You probably control your blood pressure, probably eat right. And your family history, any dementia in the family?
No. So this one, when I saw this one, I wasn't worried at all. I was like, nobody's had dementia, nobody's had Alzheimer's, nothing. Everybody stayed sharp until they were 90 and then just died.
Right.
So I feel good about this one. The AMD thing, probably going to definitely get that at some point.
Just because of family history.
Yeah. Much higher likelihood, I think.
Right.
So, yeah. Well, there weren't a lot of surprises in mine. I was like, super white, going to go blind. Gonna stay smart, so I know how bad it sucks being blind, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, so there were surprises in mine.
Yeah.
And my surprise, and I've talked about this before, and in the recent version that I did, it was confirmed.
Did you just want to feel taller?
I want to feel taller. Because I was looking up at you the way I look up at my mom.
Does this help?
And no, now it's awkward. See, there's too much of a power.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah. So you see, this whole thing is very... It's genetically based, but also culturally based. So I found out that I have two heterozygous variants that increase my risk of blood clots. Factor V Leiden, heterozygous, and prothrombin 20210A, heterozygous.
Correct.
Now, that is an interesting finding because it does put me at a considerable higher risk for having a blood clot.
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts if I came to you? And believe me, the first time I saw this, I panicked. And part of it was the way it was framed in the old system where you just get all the data. Now I was actually much more educated about it. But, you know, how would you counsel me?
Well, first I want to counsel the ZPAC.
Yes, please.
Because you bring up a really interesting thing. Again, this is one of those moments, again, where the doctor would freeze in the headlights and you know, heart would drop into our stomach. Because we like to think of ourselves as intelligent and educated. But if a patient brings in something that we don't know and have never heard of, mm-hmm. that's, like, it's scary. Yeah. It's really scary. Because the biggest risk is not that we look like an idiot, but really that they lose confidence in us, right? Yeah. And it's important that our patients have confidence in us. Is that part of the Neanderthal thing?
He made my chair too high.
I made his chair too high, and now
it was
he's
uncomfortable.
That was not what I... but that's okay.
He has many Neanderthal traits.
So this is a great opportunity because most of us now have computers in our rooms with our patients, right, because of the electronic health record. So that's where I would say, that's so cool that you brought this to me. I'm going to be honest. I'm not a geneticist, mm-hmm. right? I'm a primary care doctor, and I know a lot of things. I know about 80% of almost all subspecialties.
Yeah.
And most importantly, I know where my boundary is, and I know when to phone a friend. So, and that's when I make my referrals and send you to see my specialty friends down the street, like your famous GI doc with his great accent.
That he's got a Lexus.
Just love it.
That's right.
So, and yeah, homage to our poop emoji.
Our poop emoji.
So, oh! That was scary.
Don't panic, Mr. Pooji. Mr. Pooji, you are okay, okay? Please don't be hurt.
So now what was I saying?
80%, and then you send that to
I also have the allele for the Alzheimer's. Oh, it scares me every once in a while.
I've got it too.
So what I was saying is, you know, that's a great time to just be like, that's so cool. You know, you're kind of in my 20% right now. Mm-hmm. But let's go to my computer and let's pull up a respected resource on that really fast and take a glance. And let's talk about it really quickly in the context of this. And then I'm going to go look this up tonight. And I'm going to get back to you by phone, by email, by whatever. Or you're going to come back and follow up with me. And we're going to talk some more. And we're going to decide if we can manage this together or I need to send you to one of my genetic specialty friends down the street. Or if I don't have a genetic specialty friend down the street. Because they are few and far between. And sometimes geography is vast.
Yeah.
There's these great online consults you can get now too, which is kind of cool. So we'd look at it together and we would say, okay, this is cool because this is one of those recessive variants that actually has meaning.
Yeah.
Most of the time when we think again to that classical Mendelian genetics that you have to have two copies to be meaningful.
Right.
But in this case, that variant actually does convey like a 2 to 5-fold increased risk
mm-hmm.
In developing a clot. And I'm not going to lie, I looked that up this morning. So,
because
I'm not a clinical geneticist,
right.
And I don't know that at the top of my head. So that's very interesting, and you can talk about the genetics of that briefly with the patient mm-hmm. and how that works. And then when you get a little bit more time, you can delve a little bit deeper and realize that so far, even though there's a slightly higher risk, that 2 to 5-fold risk increase, there's not enough evidence yet for a person with one copy to start them on lifetime prophylactic right. anticoagulation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you are even more special, which we already knew.
I'm special.
And that you also have factor V, which again, in the sense of just having one copy of factor V, is not such a major concern. Again, if you go review the literature,
10% of the population may have it.
Very common, mm-hmm. not something to go run out and start anticoagulating your patients on. However, there is evidence that's published that suggests that the two in combination has an even higher risk of developing a blood clot. So that's very interesting. And certainly interesting if we were going to think about putting you on birth control, I would be concerned.
Mm. I've been sterilized forcibly by the government
yes,
because they're afraid of my children.
Let's not go there because
that's happened.
That's a whole other show.
Yeah. Mm. That's a whole other show.
So
that's true.
So that's a whole ethics discussion that we don't want to get into.
Correct.
But So that's very interesting, and again, I wouldn't expect the average primary care doctor to be able to pull that like
mm-hmm.
out of their head, and they may glean that, and again, talk about follow-up and discussing it further, maybe phoning a friend, but then, you know, in your case, we do have to have some discussion about that. What if do you have a daughter?
I do, two daughters.
What if one of your daughters or both of your daughters inherited both of these variants?
Exactly right.
And one day they may be on birth control. And I know you're going to be a good Dr. Daddy and tell them that smoking should never happen.
No, they're both going to smoke because I'm going to encourage it because it's healthy.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And not vaccinate, right?
Of course not vaccinate, because why would you? First of all, toxins, okay? Anyways. Right. Yeah.
So we're going to, you know, that's really relevant for them. Mm-hmm. And then for you, if I was your primary care doctor, I would say, well, this is really important. Right now, the evidence does not suggest we should start you on prophylactic blood thinners. But you get only one chance, right?
Yeah.
If you actually throw a clot,
yeah,
anytime, whether it was in a known context of a reason, you know, you right. flew to Europe for 12 hours, you had surgery, you broke a leg, whatever, that's it. I would then recommend lifelong anticoagulation.
And that's the decision that I independently came to based on me phoning a friend, because I didn't know as a hospitalist. I knew that these were both risks independently. What's the additive risk? I called my Stanford hematology colleague and he said, yeah, this is what I would do. And it was exactly that. And again, why is this important? Well, I never would have known this had I not done this testing. And, oh, you ask accuracy and all of this. Well, these are pretty accurate tests, but I had it confirmed then. I ordered the expensive right. test.
You said exactly what I was going to say next. Which is that these reports are great and they're informative, and mm-hmm. you certainly wouldn't have had any hint at this.
Right.
And hopefully wouldn't, you know, would never have the clinical situation develop that you find out after the fact.
Right.
But these are not
clinical diagnostic
tests. So if you have a suggestion like this and someone brings that in, then again, do what you already know best to do. Go order the corresponding clinical test that's mm-hmm. CLIA approved.
Yep.
And then that result can go on the electronic health record.
Yep.
That result can be acted on.
Brilliant, brilliant. And that's what I did. And I found out, yes, it's all true. So now when my children are old enough, I'll get them tested. We'll figure out what that piece is. And now I know, like, when I travel, because I do a lot of traveling, I make sure that they put me in a spot that isn't a Southwest cattle car. No, I'm often in a Southwest. In fact, I just flew in a Southwest
cattle
car.
That's what you talked about, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm a little short of breath, and both my legs are swollen.
Yeah, you're going to die.
I was worried about
you're
you.
You're going to die.
You flew to Portland after I saw your results.
Forrest.
Against the window.
Forrest, am I going to die? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, but it's true. But now I do. I get up. I make sure. I tell the flight attendant, listen, you got to understand, I have to walk when the seatbelt sign is on because these legs are ticking time bombs.
Right. And yesterday on my flight here.
And then
I thought this was awesome, mm-hmm. actually, in the magazine of the plane. You know, the plane magazines that are
yeah,
in there?
Yeah.
When you're super bored and you just can't stand it anymore, you start reading it.
Yeah.
At the very end, there was a whole article on DVT prevention with exercises you could do on the flight. And it was so exciting. I couldn't wait to tell you.
The only exercise I will do on a flight are Kegels.
Yeah.
Because it's my only chance to strengthen my pelvic floor.
That's right.
It's true.
Although you did have to register your legs with the FBI because they're ticking time bombs.
They are. Yeah. The Sky Marshal was like, I'm sorry, did I hear ticking time bombs in your
kids
legs?
Are here.
Oh, they are? Right oh. Shh. Her kids are here. And they're adorable. Was it Chaim?
Chaim.
I said it right.
And Noah. Noah's over there.
Hi, Noah. And Chaim. They're running the board today. Let me see something. How are our comments today?
By the way, speaking of genetics, Trey says that you two look like brother-sister. And I kind of agree.
Listen,
you know,
because of the restraining order, I can't get too close to her, but I'll say this. Well, the minute I saw her in the lobby, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's my sister. Like, literally.
I told Esther the first time I saw you long before that, but I told Esther that I always thought you were Jewish because you look like my brother.
It's the schnoz, I'm telling you.
And we share the same sort of alopecia-like disorder.
Yes.
Yeah.
Although I'm a picker. I have trichotillomania.
And yours is up here. Mine is in the eyebrows.
Also, you have a little bit of eyebrow alopecia.
I have my very own cool genetic disorder. And if any of you have it, please write in because I'm looking for a sibling somewhere, but I have named it alternating alopecia of the eyebrow,
or AAOE.
And every other year, one eyebrow falls out, and then it grows back, and the other one falls out, and then it grows back, and the other one falls out. But everyone thinks I just get really stressed,
and I switch.
So they think I have trichotillomania, right. But I do not have alopecia.
Wow.
Yes.
That's
and one
cool.
day we will clone the single nucleotide polymorphism.
That's causing
that
it.
That's causing it.
And then Tom will get a thing saying, you may be at risk for alternating eyebrow alopecia.
I know.
Of the young.
Which is super important.
Right.
It's really not super important. And I did draw it in for you guys today as best
it
as
looks
I could.
Great.
But what is important, again, kind of going back to that concept of motivational interviewing, I did personalized genomic testing myself. And as part of a way to educate myself as a provider, I wanted to understand what these reports were about. I wanted to prepare myself before the patient started
bringing
them in.
That's why we got the coupon, guys.
And, and now we're actually building a whole course to train primary care providers where they get to do their own personalized genomic testing and use that raw data not for anything clinical, but as a learning tool to actually better understand this and understand how to use it to explain to our patients. But that's not my point.
Well, what's the trial called?
That's called Test to Learn.
Test to Learn.
And that is being developed with my colleague. It was actually initially developed by my colleague in the School of Pharmacy. His name is Phil Empey.
Cool.
And I came up to him and said, this is phenomenal. It meets all the things that I'm excited to do and move it to primary care. He wanted to teach pharmacogenomics to pharmacists and to primary care providers. And I said, great. And let's add like a whole bunch of other layers to that and then blow it up and teach it everywhere. And he was just as excited. So we're working on that at Pitt right now, which is really exciting, and getting CME approval for it so that hopefully, you know, if the ZPAC wants to take the course in the future, it meets the CME checkmark too.
Got it.
But one of the things that happened when I did my personalized genomic testing is it predicted that I was going to be overweight.
Oh.
And it predicted it actually really spot on, which was kind of creepy, but true. And I was really frustrated because I actually was this total skinny stick my whole life. I was like a size zero for anyone who that means anything to, all the way through college. And then I went to graduate school and it was like, I just grew and grew and grew. And then I got married and have kids and it just kept growing, 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 growing until I got to be a 16, which was embarrassing.
From zero to 16?
In like a decade.
That's a reverse Oprah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was really frustrating. And when I got this report and it was like predicted, and then it said, by the way, these are modifiable things and it's not, you know, you can modify this prediction based on your lifestyle, which of course I know that.
Yeah.
It just but really it, inspired
it
me.
It hits you right there.
It really did.
Yep.
And so I said, that's it. Done. I am not going to let this test result predict my weight, and I am gonna modify it. And I lost 30 pounds, and it feels fantastic.
I did
my own motivational interviewing, right? And so I needed that level of information and insight to finally inspire myself to say, how can I go about and like tell patients this if I don't go and do it myself first?
See that, and that's exactly our point. So people, you know, and I know some people are concerned about privacy. I want you to go to 23andme.com/medical, and there's a lot of information on that. If you worry about what they're doing with your data and that kind of thing, you can read more about that. Here's a comment from Jill Kramer. I'm concerned that many people won't understand the nuances of this testing. A risk factor isn't the same as a mutation, and a genetic testing in an asymptomatic person is interpreted differently than in a symptomatic person.
That's
You've
right.
covered all this well, but these tests are going to be misunderstood and cause anxiety from a neurodoc.
Yeah, I mean, she's spot on in a lot of ways. I will say that I think it's complicated. So historically, we definitely were worried as providers, right, about what was going to happen to our patients when they got this data, especially when they're sitting at home at night, you know, with Dr. Google, and who didn't go to med school, and that it was going to provoke anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is we're finding out that that's not really necessarily true.
The data's saying it's not the case.
The data's saying it's not the case. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm going to go back to, I think we're in a really different era of medicine. And patients are really empowering themselves in a way that they never did before. And the truth is, everyone has anxiety. I think I was saying to you earlier, I mean, anxiety is really underrated, under-recognized, under-treated. I think we should stop teaching all subjects in elementary school and just teach cognitive
how to
behavioral
manage
therapy.
Cognitive
and
meditation.
then once they've got that under control, then we can teach them the rest of everything they need to know in life. And I once worked at a student health clinic for a year and a half, and I called it the STD anxiety clinic because that was like all anybody ever had. And And so I think that people who have anxiety have anxiety, and people who are comfortable are comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they can rapidly access information faster than they can even reach us or get to the doctor's office, that can partially alleviate some of that anxiety, can also exacerbate their anxiety, right? Because mm-hmm. everybody knows if you look up Dr. Google, then you're dying in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
But really the data is showing that patients want this information. They want to be empowered. They want to be in charge. They want to be in control. And you alluded to data security mm-hmm. and safety. But patients want that control. They want control. It's their genetics. It's their health. It's their information. That's why the electronic health record and these portals that patients can get into now and email us at 2 a.m, yeah. which I know we all love, and access their data. It's happening all the time now. And I think that what we need to do is provide the support and be ready with the background information so that we can alleviate the anxiety, which, by the way, I think is 90% of what we do anyway, every
yeah.
single day, mm-hmm. is we normalize things for people.
Agree.
And just support them through it. They're going to do it no matter what.
Yep. And that.
And I'm not going to ask our permission.
And that's exactly, that's about the most eloquent way I could imagine to describe. It's like you do this for a living almost.
Right. I think I might do.
I think she might. I mean, and that's why we partnered with, and again, this is more disclaimer purposes, we partnered with 23andMe for the show because we wanted to bring to primary care docs, to everybody on the front lines, this understanding that this is here.
Yeah.
People are doing this. It's empowering for patients. Why can't we be part of the solution instead of pushing back? Yes, we should always make sure it's correct and that the anxiety is not increased, but the data is starting to say that it's not. So we ought to be part of the solution. So if you want to try it, there's a coupon code. Let me ask you a last question. What are you working on now that's got you excited?
So I'm very excited. Since I have joined UPMC and the University of Pittsburgh, it's like all the doors have just been opening up, and it's so much fun. So as a family doctor, I do full spectrum family medicine. So I deliver babies. I do hospice. I'll give a shout out to my Bethany Hospice team, so they'll be excited.
Nice.
and then everything in between. But in addition to that, I now do 30% research, and I really call myself a research catalyst. Mm. So one, because I think it's cool to be an enzyme, and two, because I still have that PTSD
right.
from my own research as a graduate student. And so I am working with the Clinical Translational Science Institute on a couple of different projects. So one is that I am working on special populations, which is really now being renamed underrepresented in biomedical research. So populations to make sure that they're being included and that barriers are not being put in place to their inclusion in research, as well as addressing research questions that are really important to those populations. And I'm going to go back and add Neanderthal to that growing list of categories.
Special populations.
I love it. So I underrepresented in biomedical research. I don't think we have a lot of Neanderthals being represented right now. So, and then the second thing, which is even more exciting, in my opinion, is really seeing the fruition of all of my dreams and this marriage between genetics and family medicine come true, which is precision medicine. And so, as many people know, there's a national precision medicine research project that Obama funded that is now had increased funding from the current administration. So it's got bipartisan support. It's called the All of Us National Research Project. University of Pittsburgh and our mentor, Dr. Steve Reese, received a grant to administer our local version of that, which we call PA Cares for Us. And nationally, we're going to recruit 1 million people into this precision medicine database, which is super exciting. And more daunting, we're going to recruit 150,000 of those from Western Pennsylvania. So it's a lot of work, but it's really important. And it's really important that we recruit a huge, diverse population so that we can start, remember I was talking about the omes earlier, so that we can start understanding how our history, how our genomics, how our microbiome, how our environment and our nutrition, you know, we have a lot of hints and we're really recognizing the critical influence of all of these things, but we need to get enough research now together so that scientists can truly advance precision medicine, which is another word for
Health 3.0.
Yes.
I thought I was getting excited.
I know.
Like, it's the repersonalization of medicine.
It is.
So we can use the scientific personalization in the form of what that is, and then this. like you said, it's about alleviating anxiety, knowing the patient. Why did they order the test? What's going on? And you know,
and putting it back in the context of their life.
In their life. And the last thing I wanted to say is, you know, there was a lot of drama with FDA and all of that over consumer genetic testing. You know, the FDA actually requires consumer comprehension as part of the way to proceed forward with testing. And when they looked at it, about 90% of consumers understood the concepts that were educated upon in the modules to prepare. So our patients are ready for this. It's a question of just, are we? And I think we need to be. And talking to someone like you who's so passionate about it, I'm even doubly convinced now that the ZPAC can learn about it, that we can get more educated and be on board this revolution instead of trying to fight it.
Yeah.
And make it better.
And I think really this personalized genomic testing, direct-to-consumer testing, as much as it has scared providers, mm-hmm. is driving this revolution.
Yeah.
Because that is how the information is getting out there to yep. everyone in this country. That's how the education is advancing. That's how the doctors are learning.
Yeah.
It's really a catalyst.
You look how you did that.
I know.
And, you know, to tie it all together, I will say if I hadn't done it, I would never have understood. So now that I've done it, first of all, I learned something about my health that could save my life potentially because I will now take precautions. It may save my children's life. And then on top of that, I understand better how to talk to my patients about it.
That's right.
My Linda Massart, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, family medicine doc, PhD in awesomeness. Is she not one of the tribe of the ZPAC through and through?
I'm so honored.
Oh my gosh, the honor is mine.
I told, you know, when I got the invitation to come today, I wasn't sure I could talk. I just thought I might be like this the whole time.
You? No way! She puts me to shame in being able to educate people. Like, I'm just like, okay, flapping my meat hole going, you should learn about this. And she's like, well, no, here's exactly how it works. You have a gift.
Thank you.
I'm glad you use it.
I love it.
ZPAC, if you have questions for us, hit them in the comments. If you want to learn more about 23andMe stuff, go to 23andMe.com/medical. And there's lots of different links there to learn different things. And I don't know, do you want to take us out with a we out?
We out.
She just said it. We out. Oh, wait, this is the thumbnail. We need the thumbnail. Get in here.
I don't know if this is working, but it's dope. Say something inflammatory.
The thing is, I just love Z. He's a great guy. I hate you so much, Tom Heineberg. We're out.